Hi, my name is Eliane Goldstein, and you're listening to The Effect on Us.
When I went downstairs to play with the kids with whom I'd played all my life, all of a sudden they're calling me a dirty little Jew and to walk in the sidewalk where I belong.
I had the courage to say, I have to get out. I was just so infused with the will to live that I said, I don't mind leaving my parents.
Do you experience any pain from what they would do?
Every single second of my life, and I will for the rest of my life.
The Effect on Us podcast. Here's Eliane Goldstein.
The Effect on Us is a podcast for people of all ages to learn about controversial subjects and the ties it has to people nowadays. In this season, the focus of the series is the Holocaust. You'll be able to hear some of the best survival stories I've ever heard from people that went through the Second World War and learn more about the effect the Holocaust had on people from Generation 1 to Generation 3.
Did you know that only about 10% of the Germans who worked at Auschwitz were ever put on trial? In this episode, I'm talking to Ray Groper, who was shipped off to Uzbekistan for the war.
What is your name?
My name is Rachel Groper.
Where were you born?
I was born in a prisoner of war camp in the coal mines of Siberia, in what was then the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, USSR.
What year?
Oh, now you're asking a difficult question. 1941. Have you done the math?
No, I'm trying to do it in my head, but it's not.
Yes,
like...
I'm 81.
Oh, okay. So I know that you were born during the war, right? But do you remember anything from that time?
I do. I have capsule memories that come back to me even to this day.
Can you tell me about your family?
My family came from Warsaw, Poland. Each of their, my father's family came from a small town called Pszczyca, where he was part of a very Orthodox family and a Rebbe that was very famous when you look at the history of some of the shtetls in Eastern Europe. My mother lived her whole life in Warsaw, but her family came from a little town outside of Warsaw called Dęblin. They lived a reasonably pleasant life, given that it was Poland and that there always was some sense of otherness and some sense of anti-Semitism. Each of them had businesses. My mother had a boutique business with her brother. She had attended a design school, and she was a trained millinery designer. Now, for regular people, millinery means hats, ladies' hats in particular.
What about siblings?
My mother had a brother whose name was Shimon, and he spent most of my early life with us. He married after the war and brought his wife first to Israel and then to us here in Canada. My father had two brothers and two sisters. One brother who survived the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland, and one brother, Aaron, who lived with us for a while and then moved to Argentina, where the two sister siblings had moved just before the war in 1936-37.
So what was it like growing up in a camp?
Well, that's kind of a partial question, Eliane. I was born in a camp, so have no consciousness of it. My mother was having, during her pregnancy, to work underground in digging coal. They were prisoners, so they didn't have the freedom to act. Food was scarce. Security was always an issue. They did manage to stay together, along with my grandmother, who was a single parent. And they lived in that mine for at least 2 years. And Russia at that time, or the Soviet Union at that time, was governed by 5-year plans. So these were organized time frames that the government set for the production of coal, for the production of food, for all sorts of economic necessities. And the coal mines had a quota to meet, and they met that quota, digging every day. So you can imagine, I always wondered and would ask my mother why on earth she would want to be pregnant in that horrible time. And she always answered me that it was her only hope for the future. And she carried me for 9 months. And when she went into labor, the guards would not permit my father to go with her. There were no hospitals. There was no prenatal care of any kind. You know what that is, Eliane, prenatal care? And so they found a midwifery clinic, if you can call it that. And my father tried to go with her, and the guards lifted their rifles and threatened to kill him. But he went anyway on a sleigh. Siberia has minus 40 degrees, is not the coldest of temperatures. And I was born there, and my mother was determined to keep me alive. If you met me in person, you wouldn't think I was slight, but I was born weighing barely 2 pounds. And soon after that, the quota was met at that coal mine, and all the prisoners were put on open train cars, you know, the flat cars that you see for shipment of supplies on a train, not passenger cars. And there were about 100 kids on that train going to the next prison, the next destination. And of those 100, because of the cold exposure, about 10 kids survived. And I was one of them. So my mother was quite determined to keep me alive, trading everything they owned or could find for food, mostly sugar and clean water. And that train went from minus 40 to plus 40. They were shipped to a country called Uzbekistan. If you look on the map, have you seen the map of Europe and Asia? I'm sure you have in school. And you know where Afghanistan is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, near it are a bunch of stans, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. And they were all part of what was then USSR. And my parents, my family were shipped to Uzbekistan, where the men, not the women, like in the coal mines, were forced to work in flour mills, to live in whatever shelter they could find. It wasn't a camp. And they worked in flour mills every day. No weekends off, no regular hours, just long days. But one of the advantages of working there is that it's a wheat growing area. So they were able to steal flour, wheat flour, and they would put it into their trousers and tie the bottom of their slacks, of the pants they were wearing, and then empty that. And that's one of my childhood memories of my father and my uncle coming home and emptying the flour into a big kind of pail where my grandmother would use the flour to make food, to make bread.
What other memories do you have?
Of what? My childhood? Of my family? Of which
of your childhood?
I have memories of fear of response to knocks on doors, of Russian military police walking in to try and arrest my parents, of I have memories of being pulled by the hand across a border and my mother covering my mouth to keep quiet. A lot of it is a lot of the news today in Ukraine is a reminder to me when I see what has happened to some of the victims, when they try to run from one side to the other, when they grab whatever they can and just get onto trains or cars. In fact, the dreams that I used to have as a young girl of soldiers chasing me, I hadn't had those dreams in a very, very long time. But some of the news that's happened recently has provoked bits of those again. I'm a little girl again, being pulled by my mother especially, and racing away from danger. Those are some of the memories. I remember when we came into the displaced person camps in Austria, having survived that, and I haven't told you that part of the story yet, but being put in the first kindergarten and being with other children and listening to games. The idea of play was so foreign, but once we came out of the Russian prisoner camps, it became, I guess you could call it somewhat normal, somewhat of a childhood.
Okay. So what was it like for you to start to be able to have like a childhood again?
Well, it felt kind of okay. A great uncle of my mother's who had grown up in England went through the United Nations refugee search function, and he found us in the camp in outside of Salzburg, Austria. And he brought me my very first doll. And I will always remember that. Even at this age, I can remember she had a white dress and her hair was long and flowing. And the dress had little flowers across the top. And I think I held on to her for quite a long time. It seemed like the most marvelous of gifts to get. And there was a kindergarten, as I told you earlier, in that camp. And I remember studying and I remember learning words. Now, the issue was language, because my native language, my parents' first language was Polish. And I never learned to speak it, though I understand some words, because my parents were so terribly upset about what had been taken from them and how they were treated. So I was forbidden to speak it. But Yiddish was my basic first language. So the kindergarten was in Yiddish. But while we were in those camps from 1946 to 1949, there was discussion about where we would settle next. And the first choice in 1948, can you guess where that would be? The first choice in May of 1948?
The United States.
Mm-mm.
Argentina?
What did you?
Oh, Israel.
You got it. So we got all packed and ready to go after the state was declared. And I can still talk of childhood memories. I can remember people running around the camp sobbing, just crying as hard as you could hear. And I couldn't understand as a little girl why everybody was laughing and crying at the same time. And I have a picture in an old album of my father and mother standing with an Israeli flag and a big, huge bouquet of flowers that my father had found or brought home, so excited. We never got to Israel to live because my grandmother got very ill and my mother wouldn't leave her alone. So we stayed put in the camps, and my mother ended up being recruited because of her training to come to Canada. And that's how we ended up here.
When, like during the war or even after, did you know that you were Jewish?
Oh, yes. My father was an Orthodox Jew, a bit secular when I was young, but much more observant as he got older. And in Uzbekistan, in Samarkand, in order to survive and to be able to trade for food and other things, he befriended some of the tribal chieftains. And the fact that he had studied Torah was very respected and very appreciated by the tribal chieftains. They would sit and compare the Quran to the Torah and it helped in the exchange for food and some protection for our family. So yes, I always knew, and it was always clear. It's also the reason they were imprisoned. It's also the reason they were robbed of everything they owned, but it was never, ever a doubt. And I wasn't hidden as other survivors have been as non-Jews. I had an aunt, my father's oldest brother's wife, who in Warsaw had Aryan papers. Do you know what that means?
Yes. But can you explain it for the people that don't know?
Beg your pardon?
Can you explain it for the people that don't know?
She looked fair and blonde and blue-eyed, and she was able to get documentations to say that she wasn't Jewish. And she was able to stay out of the ghetto in Warsaw. But regrettably, someone found out and told on her, and she was shot and killed. I don't think my uncle ever survived that, but he did survive, and he did rescue himself and his son by staying hidden, basically in the sewers below the ghetto and in the sewers of Warsaw, out of which he escaped, to live after the war in Europe and in Germany, if you can believe it.
So what was it like for you to come to Canada?
Well, before I tell you about that, I'll tell you that I never spoke a word of English. When I was a 7-year-old, 8-year-old child in the displaced person camps in Austria. So my first 3 English words were okay, Coca-Cola, and Hershey bar. And if you can guess, this came from the American soldiers who came in to rescue any prisoners and to take care of them, and especially the Jewish soldiers who found other Jewish families, of which there were many in our camp. They emptied out their supply stores, their PXs, and brought us treats that they thought we would love. And that's how I got to know the word Hershey bar. I didn't know it was what my mother would say, chocolate. And they said okay to everything. And my mother quietly said about the Coca-Cola, she said in Yiddish to me, be polite and say thank you. I think it's poison. I think she was right. She didn't want us to drink other than pure drinks, of course, milk or water or tea when you got old enough, as she would say. So she applied and she got recruited, and she was allowed to bring her husband and her children to Canada. And she was not permitted. I thought you would ask me what happened to Grandma. Grandma had to stay behind in the camps for a whole year before my mother could qualify to bring her mother. So that was a very, very difficult decision and year. We came to Canada. We landed in Halifax. Have you been to Halifax, Eliane?
Never.
You should go, and you should go visit, given that you're doing this project, go visit Pier 21 at St. Mary's University has documented on a database all the people who landed in that port, and that was the primary landing port. So I found our name. I found the ship we came on, and I took a picture of it, and the students helped me get a copy, and I have it for my children to see as a souvenir. So we landed in Halifax, and my mother asked in her broken, she spoke many languages, but not English, and she asked the immigration man where the largest Jewish community was. And he said, Montreal. So she said, that's where I want to go. And that's how we ended up in Montreal. And here, JIAS, the Jewish Immigrant Aid Society, met us and found us a rental room in someone else's house. And we lived there for a few months until we could find a house of our own to rent. And it was difficult because many owners of houses did not want to rent to children. So my parents had to find what was then called key money. They had to pay. I remembered clearly, my father as well, were so worked up about paying $200 to have permission to live in a house with children. And so we moved to a street called Jean Mance. I don't know if you've been on it, but it's off Avenue du Parc. I don't know what it's called now, but it's called Jean Mance for sure, between Fermont and Laurier. But we weren't speaking French then, so we said Fairmount and Laurier. And we lived there for quite a long time. And that's where I went to school. I went to elementary school. I went to Jewish people school in the afternoon, which was JPPS, where it originated on Waverly and Fairmount. And I was one of nine kids who went to high school in Hebrew as well as in Yiddish, mostly Yiddish, and went to a very famous high school in Montreal, Baron Bing. I'm sure you've come across that. Have you? Have you ever heard of Baron Bing High School?
My grandfather went there.
Oh, there you go. So I don't know if he went when I was there, but it was the core school for the working class Jewish community. If you lived in a higher economic level, you were in Outremont and you went to Strathcona or Outremont High. And that's where my life started. My community and my family and my friends and my activities were centered around Baron Bing. We would all walk together. We would all do activities together. Most of us went on to university together. There were no CEGEPs.
How was life different from you in Montreal than it was in Europe?
Life was, my mother was working full time, as was my father. And life was, I thought it was ordinary. It seemed unusual, I discovered later in life, when I talk to kids who grew up as we know it, normal, as my children and grandchildren grew up. We were involved more in the community. The Y was our focal point. Our socializing was there. If we went to camp, it was a community camp. So it was Camp Nébrith or Camp Wooden Acres. You may have heard of those as you talk to different people. And that was our experience out. Before I went to camp, my parents found a way to rent a house in the Laurentians because they were very concerned that we had fresh air and not in the city. So we would stay there with my grandmother. That's where I learned how to make gefilte fish. We waited for my parents to come on Shabbat to be with us for the weekend. And my grandmother would give instructions and I had to do the mixing and mishing. But life on a regular basis was school, after school Hebrew, piano lessons, activities outside really on Fletcher's Field or on the street. Nobody on the street owned a car. So we all bused or drove or, you know, publicly. On high holidays, the entire street of Park Avenue was filled with people dressed up in their clothes for Yom Tov and walking up and down and greeting each other. It was an annual ritual.
Is there any message that you want to give to people in the future generations?
Have you got about an hour or two or three? I have hope. I have hope that your generation of kids will learn how to live with every other community, that there will be less hatred, less anti-Semitism, less violence, I'm saying it in a context when everything around me is reminding me of the 1930s and 40s. I'm hoping the human species can figure out how to live with each other and to accept each other. I'm reading a book that's part of a discussion group I'm involved with. That's such a reminder to me of what the potential of people is, but what is not fulfilled as a potential. It's a book called Caste, C-A-S-T-E. You know what a caste is? A division.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's how people see each other and where they classify each other. And we all do that to some degree. The question is, can we do it and live peacefully with each other? I've hope for the future, but I am very dismayed by the present. And it doesn't bode well. I read the recent surveys of B'nai B'rith and of the Anti-Defamation League. I don't know if you've seen them. The number of incidents of hatred and anti-Semitism in Canada has increased tremendously over the last year, and the same so in the United States. What struck me is that the numbers in Canada were as high, even though we are a tenth of the population. So I'm just hopeful that we can overcome this. I don't know if it's realistic, but it's a hope.
Yeah, the other day there was the Israel rally, and it was across from my parents' office, and my dad was looking out the window, and there was this guy holding an Israeli flag that was, like, being attacked by two guys.
Yeah, I saw it on the news.
Yeah, that was my dad that went down to help him.
Yeah, I saw it on the news. Each time it happens, my innards turn and wrinkle, and I, to the extent that a prayer can help, I hope that it can be mitigated, because I don't see any difference. I've worked among every possible ethnicity and persuasion my whole life, and I've never seen anybody as different, and I haven't classified. And I'm a survivor. I should be the one hating. I should be the one feeling bitter. And I just hope, I can't bear to look at what people are doing to other people. And as horrible as what's happening in Ukraine is, during the time that we survived the war, there were Ukrainian people who weren't very kind or caring to Jewish people. And yet today, and that's the positive part, yet today there are teams from Israel and from all other countries helping them. And hopefully that's a sign of the new generation.
Yeah. Anyway, is there any last thing that you would like to add before we wrap up?
No, there isn't. I think I've said it all. My hope is for the future. I'm very pleased to see someone of your generation interested in old goats like me.
Okay, well then, thank you so much.
Thank you, and I wish you well.
Join me next time when I talk to Sally Singer, Ann Novak, and Ruth Zimmer. These three sisters, along with their brother, Saul Fink, who could not join us, are likely the oldest living Holocaust siblings in the world right now. If you like this episode, please like and subscribe and tell your friends. This is Eliane Goldstein. Tune in next time to The Effect on Us. And remember, history will not repeat itself. Bye!